A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it lands right in the middle of something that's been quietly reshaping how money works in a lot of countries. Israel passed a law that caps cash transactions at 6,000 shekels for businesses, about $1,600, and 15,000 shekels for individuals, roughly $4,000. Break those limits, and you're looking at penalties up to 30% of the excess amount. The question is, how are Israel and other countries restricting cash to shrink their shadow economies, and what actually happens when they do it?
The penalty structure is what grabs you first, right? That's not a slap on the wrist. That's designed to make the compliance cost of getting caught higher than the tax savings from staying off the books. And Israel's not alone here. Greece caps cash at 500 euros. Spain at 1,000 for businesses, 2,500 for tourists, France at 1,000, Italy at 1,000. These aren't suggestions, they're hard legal limits with real enforcement behind them.
The government's essentially saying, we don't trust you with your own money above a certain threshold, unless there's a paper trail.
That's the surface read, but let's define what we're actually talking about. The shadow economy isn't the black market. It's not drug deals or weapons trafficking. It's legal goods and services, home renovations, restaurant meals, tutoring, construction work that are deliberately hidden from tax authorities. The work is legal. The concealment isn't. And the OECD estimates this accounts for 15 to 30% of GDP in developed nations. In Israel, the IMF pegs it around 15%.
15% of GDP is what? Something like $70 billion a year in untaxed activity?
Roughly that ballpark, yeah. And cash is the lubricant. No third-party reporting, no digital footprint, no counterparty record. You pay a contractor in cash, the transaction exists only in the memory of two people and maybe a handshake. The tax authority sees nothing.
Which makes cash the monetary equivalent of a ghost. And governments have decided they'd like fewer ghosts.
Israel's cash law. Formally Amendment 5778 to the Prohibition on Money Laundering Law, fully enforced by 2022, sets three tiers. 6,000 shekels for business transactions, 15,000 for individuals, and 50,000 for nonprofit donations. Violations trigger fines of 15 to 30% of the transaction amount. And here's the thing most coverage misses. This isn't just about the transaction itself, it's about what the law enables downstream.
Walk me through that.
The law creates what you might call a reporting cascade. Israel's tax authority already requires banks to report any cash deposit over 50,000 shekels, about $13,500, to the Money Laundering and Terror Financing Prohibition Authority. That's been in place for years. The cash law adds a second layer. Now, even if you never deposit the cash, the act of receiving it above the cap is itself a violation. The government doesn't need to prove tax evasion. The cash transaction alone is the offense.
They've decoupled the crime from the underlying tax evasion. You don't have to prove someone didn't declare income. You just prove they took too much cash.
That's much easier to prove. A receipt, a witness, a bank withdrawal on the payer's side that doesn't match any declared expense. Any of those creates a paper trail that points to the violation. It's a clever bit of legal architecture. They've criminalized the medium, not just the evasion.
Like making it illegal to wear a ski mask into a bank, even if you haven't robbed it yet.
That's actually a perfect analogy. The mask itself isn't the crime, but it's a strong enough indicator that we've decided to make it one. Think about how that shifts the burden of proof. You don't need to prove intent to rob, you just need to prove the mask was on. Same thing here. You don't need to prove intent to evade taxes. You just need to prove the cash changed hands above the limit. It turns a complicated forensic accounting exercise into a simple threshold check.
Which also means the enforcement net catches a lot more fish, including fish that weren't really doing anything wrong in the traditional sense. The contractor who just prefers cash, the small business owner who didn't know the law changed. that technically violate us now.
Ignorance of the law is famously not a defense. Now, the second mechanism here is what I'd call the digital trail enforcement loop. When cash is capped, transactions move to bank transfers, credit cards, or digital wallets. In Israel, that's things like Bit or Pepper Pay. Every one of those leaves metadata: timestamp, geolocation, counterparty, amount, category code. Tax authorities can cross-reference that against declared income.
If you declare 50,000 shekels in income, but your digital payment apps show 200,000 in inflows, the math does the investigation for you.
And Israel's been building toward this for a while. Since 2024, all business-to-business transactions above a certain threshold have to use the Heshbonnet digital invoicing system. It's a real-time reporting platform that sends invoice data directly to the tax authority. They're not waiting for you to file your annual return. They're seeing transactions as they happen.
That's the panopticon of tax collection. Every transaction is a little confession to the state.
It is, and we'll get to the privacy implications because they're enormous. But let me give you the third mechanism first: sector-specific targeting. Israel's law exempts certain transactions. Private individuals selling used goods under 15,000 shekels, payments to government agencies, transactions between family members. The exemptions are designed to avoid overreach while concentrating enforcement on high evasion sectors.
Construction, I assume?
Construction is the poster child. The OECD estimates that cash-intensive sectors, construction, hospitality, personal services, account for 60 to 70% of shadow economy activity in developed nations. In Israel, the tax authority estimated that about 40% of construction activity was off the books before the cash law.
That's not a few guys doing side jobs on weekends. That's nearly half the sector.
Here's where we have actual post-implementation data. After the cash law took effect, the tax authority reported a 12% increase in declared income from the construction sector in 2023. 12% in 1 year. That's billions of shekels moving from the shadow economy into the formal one.
The question is whether that's real economic growth or just a shift in reporting.
It's almost certainly a shift in reporting. The work was happening before. It's just that now it's being declared. And from the government's perspective, that's the win. It's not about growing the pie. It's about getting a slice of the pie that was already being baked.
That raises a follow-up question. If the work was happening before at a certain price, and now it's happening with a tax burden attached, someone's paying for that. Either the contractor's margins shrink, or the customer pays more, or some combination. The pie didn't change size, but the government took a bite, so someone else's slice got smaller.
And it's the part of the story that gets glossed over in the triumphant press releases about increased tax revenue. The cost of compliance, the tax itself, plus the accounting overhead, plus the time spent navigating digital invoicing systems, that cost lands somewhere. In competitive markets, it probably lands on the contractor's margins. In tight labor markets, it probably gets passed to the customer. Either way, the 12% increase in declared income isn't free money. It's a transfer.
If you're a small contractor operating on thin margins, that transfer might be the difference between staying afloat and going under, or going back off the books in a more sophisticated way.
Which we'll get to. Let's look at Greece for a comparison, because 500 euros is a drastically lower cap than Israel's. That's basically saying you can't buy a used car or pay a contractor in cash at all.
500 euros? What is that in practical terms? A nice dinner for four with wine, maybe? A modest piece of furniture?
It's a weekend grocery run for a large family if you're shopping at a market. It's a single car repair. It's a short domestic flight. The cap is so low that it essentially criminalizes cash for any transaction beyond daily incidentals. And it came in 2021, paired with another mandate: all businesses had to install point-of-sale terminals by 2020. The combination was powerful. The Greek Independent Authority for Public Revenue reported a 15% increase in VAT revenue in the first year alone.
15% VAT increase is enormous. That's not marginal improvement. That's a structural shift.
It speaks to how much activity was hidden. Greece's shadow economy was estimated at over 20% of GDP before these reforms. When you force transactions through POS terminals, you're not just capturing the transaction value. You're capturing the VAT, the income tax, the social security contributions. Every euro that moves from cash to digital generates multiple tax streams.
The multiplier effect of surveillance.
If you want to be cynical about it, yes. But let's also acknowledge that Greece had a particular problem. Years of capital controls, a population that had learned to distrust banks, and tax evasion that was practically a national sport. The 500 euro cap was a sledgehammer because the situation called for one.
Though I wonder, when you set the cap that low, doesn't it start to feel absurd to ordinary people? If I can't pay my dentist in cash, or buy a used washing machine from my neighbor without a bank transfer, at some point the law starts to feel disconnected from how life actually works.
That's where enforcement reality meets legislative ambition. Greece has had mixed compliance with the 500 euro cap precisely because it's so low. Local markets, rural areas, informal transactions between neighbors. These continue in cash because the alternative feels absurd. Enforcement is concentrated on visible, high-value targets. Nobody's auditing your washing machine purchase. But the law is on the books, and that creates a kind of selective enforcement that has its own problems.
Selective enforcement tends to fall hardest on people who are already visible to the state for other reasons. If you're already in the system, you have a registered business, you file taxes, you're easier to audit. The people who are truly invisible stay invisible.
That's one of the paradoxes of cash caps. The people most likely to be caught are the semi-compliant, the ones who are mostly following the rules but slip up on a cash transaction. The fully non-compliant just stay in the shadows. So we've got the mechanisms, reporting thresholds, digital trail enforcement, sector targeting. These seem to work, at least in the narrow sense of increasing declared income and VAT revenue. But you mentioned knock-on effect. Let's start with financial exclusion. The Bank of Israel reported in 2024 that 40% of Haredi households lack bank accounts. These are largely communities that operate on cash for cultural and religious reasons. They're not evading taxes. They're living according to communal norms that predate digital banking by centuries.
The cash law has exemptions for religious institutions and charitable donations, but that doesn't help the individual who needs to pay a tuition bill, or hire a mohel, or buy groceries in bulk.
The exemptions cover institutional giving, not daily life. In 2023, the Israeli NGO Kav LaOved reported that 23% of Haredi small businesses had to either close or go fully underground because of cash restrictions. They couldn't access banking services, either because they lacked the documentation, or because community norms discouraged it, or because the banks themselves weren't equipped to serve them.
A law designed to bring people into the formal economy ended up pushing some of them out of it entirely.
Or deeper underground. And that's not just an Israeli problem. Across Europe, cash restrictions disproportionately affect the elderly, low-income households and rural populations. The European Central Bank found that 55% of euro area consumers consider cash important for daily transactions. Among those over 65, it's over 70%. These aren't tax evaders. They're people for whom cash is the familiar, accessible, trusted medium.
There's something almost colonial about it. The state deciding that your community's financial norms are unacceptable and must be reformed, whether you consent or not.
I think that's a strong framing, but not an unfair one. And it connects to the second major concern, privacy. Israel already operates what's called Merkaz Hamayanot, the Spring Center, which aggregates data from tax authorities, social security, and banking records. Cash restrictions expand the surveillance net. Every transaction you make becomes part of a permanent, searchable record.
The Israel Democracy Institute did a poll on this.
They did, in 2024. 68% of Israelis opposed further cash restrictions on privacy grounds. That's a supermajority. And these aren't libertarian ideologues. This is a mainstream, cross-sectoral concern. People understand intuitively that when every transaction is recorded, the state knows not just what you earn, but what you buy, where you go, who you pay.
The state knows you have a gambling problem before your spouse does. It knows you sing a therapist, or that you donated to a controversial cause, or that you bought a book that's politically sensitive.
All of that. And let me give you a concrete example of why this matters beyond the abstract. In 2023, an Israeli journalist filed a Freedom of Information request and discovered that the tax authority's data aggregation system had flagged over 200,000 citizens for lifestyle discrepancies, meaning their reported income didn't match their observed spending patterns. Some of those flags were based on things like grocery store loyalty card data and utility bill patterns, not criminal investigations, just algorithmic phishing expeditions.
Once you're flagged, you're in the system. Even if you've done nothing wrong, you're now a person of interest to the tax authority. That flag follows you.
And the threshold for being flagged keeps dropping as the data gets more granular. When every coffee purchase and parking meter payment is digitized, the state can construct a financial portrait of you that's more detailed than what you could produce yourself. Most people don't track their own spending at that level. The state does it for them without asking.
Which brings us to the third unintended consequence, and the one I find most darkly amusing, evasion displacement. You mentioned crypto earlier.
When you squeeze cash, shadow activity doesn't disappear. It migrates. Israel's tax authority reported a 300% increase in cryptocurrency-related tax audits from 2022 to 2025.
300%? So the shadow economy didn't shrink. It just put on a different mask.
There was a case in 2024 where Israeli authorities seized $1.7 million in crypto from a construction contractor who had shifted 80% of his business to Bitcoin payments specifically to avoid the cash limits. He wasn't hiding less income. He was hiding it differently.
Arguably hiding it more effectively, because tracing crypto transactions requires a whole different set of investigative capabilities that most tax authorities are still building.
The contractor in that case wasn't a crypto early adopter or a libertarian ideologue. He was a pragmatic tax evader who adapted to the new regulatory environment. The cash law didn't make him compliant. It made him more sophisticated. He now uses mixers, privacy coins, and cross-chain bridges that make tracing exponentially harder than following a cash envelope.
Which raises the question, if the goal is to reduce the shadow economy, and the shadow economy just shapeshifts, are we actually solving anything, or are we just playing whack-a-mole with more sophisticated hammers?
This is where the Sweden comparison becomes really instructive. Sweden has nearly eliminated cash. It's about 1% of GDP, down from 10% in 2000. But they did it through voluntary adoption, not legal mandates. There's no cash limit law in Sweden. Banks have simply stopped handling cash at 80% of branches because customers stopped asking for it.
What drove that?
It's a mobile payment system launched in 2012 by a consortium of Swedish banks. It now handles 40% of all person-to-person transactions. It's instant, it's free for individuals, and it's tied to phone numbers. You don't need a card reader or a special app. You just need someone's phone number. Adoption was organic. People chose it because it was better than cash, not because cash was illegal.
The shadow economy numbers?
Sweden's shadow economy is estimated at 7% of GDP, among the lowest in the OECD. That's less than half of Israel's 15%. And they achieved it without criminalizing cash, without financial exclusion, crises, and without the privacy backlash.
The data suggests that making digital payments genuinely better, faster, cheaper, more convenient, works better than making cash illegal.
That's the uncomfortable lesson for policymakers who prefer mandates. The stick approach generates compliance statistics. The carrot approach generates actual behavioral change. And the two aren't the same thing.
Although I wonder if Sweden is replicable. Small population, high trust in institutions, strong social safety net, homogeneous banking culture. You drop Swish into a country with lower institutional trust, and you might not get the same adoption curve.
That's fair. Context matters enormously. Israel has a more fragmented population, lower trust in government, and communities with specific cultural relationships to cash. The mandate approach was arguably a response to the fact that voluntary adoption wasn't happening fast enough or at all in certain sectors.
There's also the trust question in a different direction. In Sweden, people trust their banks and their government. In Greece, after the financial crisis and the bailout and the capital controls, people had very good reasons not to trust banks with all their money. When you've lived through a period where the ATMs literally stopped dispensing cash, you're going to keep some euro bills under the mattress no matter how good the payment app is.
That's the path dependence problem. A country's financial history shapes what's politically and practically possible. Greece couldn't do a Sweden-style voluntary transition because the trust wasn't there, so they went with the sledgehammer. And it worked in the revenue sense. VAT collections are up. but it also created a two-tier system where the banked population uses cards and the unbanked population uses cash for everything under 500 euros and hopes nobody's watching.
Which brings us to what someone actually does about this. If you're a business owner in Israel or anywhere with similar restrictions, what's the practical path?
The compliance burden is real but manageable. The key is integrating with tax authority reporting systems from the start. In Israel, the Heshbonite digital invoicing system has been mandatory for all B2B transactions since 2024. It's not optional. If you're doing business-to-business work, you need to be generating digital invoices that flow directly to the tax authority. The upfront cost is a POS system and some accounting software integration, maybe a few thousand shekels. But the alternative is a 30% penalty, which is catastrophic.
If you're just someone who values privacy and wants to buy a gift without your bank knowing, or avoid data brokers building a profile on your spending,
the privacy trade-off is becoming unavoidable. You can use privacy-focused digital payment systems. Monero gets mentioned in these conversations, though it carries legal risk in many jurisdictions. You can structure transactions to stay under reporting thresholds, though that's legally dicey if it looks like structuring. Or you can accept that in a less cash society, financial privacy is a diminishing resource.
That's a grim set of options. None of them are good.
They're all trade-offs, and which one you pick depends on what you're optimizing for. If you're optimizing for legal safety, you accept the surveillance. If you're optimizing for privacy, you accept some legal risk. If you're optimizing for convenience, you use whatever app everyone else is using and stop thinking about it.
The third bucket is probably where most people land, not because they've made a conscious choice, but because friction is the real decision maker.
That's exactly how Sweden won, not by arguing with people about privacy versus compliance, but by making the digital option so frictionless that cash felt like the inconvenience.
I want to pause on that friction point, because I think it's more profound than it sounds. When Sweden made Swish, they didn't just make a payment system. They made a payment system that was faster than counting out bills and making change. That's the bar. If your digital payment takes longer than handing over a 20, people won't use it. If it costs more than zero, people won't use it for small transactions. Swish cleared both bars. Most digital payment systems don't.
Most digital payment systems are designed by banks thinking about security and compliance first, user experience fifth. Swish was designed by a consortium that understood they were competing with the most user-friendly payment method ever invented, physical cash. Cash has zero latency, zero fees, zero authentication steps, zero battery requirements. Beating that is hard.
Most governments trying to reduce cash usage don't seem to understand that they're asking people to switch from a perfect user experience to a worse one, for the government's benefit. That's a hard sell.
It's an impossible sell without either making the digital option better or making cash worse, through caps, penalties, or outright bans. Sweden chose the first path. Israel and Greece chose the second.
For policymakers, what's the takeaway from all this? If you're a finance ministry looking at these models, what should you actually do?
The data suggests a phased approach works better than sudden mandates. Sweden's voluntary adoption achieved lower shadow economy rates than Israel's forced limits, with fewer social costs. If I'm advising a government, I'd say start with mandatory POS terminals. That's Greece's model, and it works. Then invest in a national instant payment system that's better than cash. Make digital payments free, instant, and universal. Only after that infrastructure is in place and adoption is high do you consider cash caps, and even then with generous exemptions for vulnerable populations.
Probably with a longer phase-in than anyone wants. The Haredi community issue in Israel isn't going to be solved by a law. It requires banking products that respect communal norms, maybe Sharia-compliant equivalents for the Jewish context, financial literacy programs, trust building. That's a decade of work, not a legislative session.
None of that work is exciting. It doesn't generate headlines the way a crackdown on tax evasion does. But it's the difference between a policy that works on paper and one that works in people's actual lives.
Let me poke at one assumption here. The whole framing of this, from governments, from the OECD, from a lot of the coverage, is that the shadow economy is a problem to be eliminated. Is that actually true in all cases?
That's an important question. The shadow economy isn't all tax evasion by wealthy contractors. It's also the cleaning lady who gets paid in cash because she can't navigate the bureaucracy of formal employment. It's the small farmer selling produce at a roadside stand. It's the teenager tutoring math for pocket money. Some portion of the shadow economy is essentially the informal safety net, work that exists because the formal economy has barriers to entry.
When you crush the shadow economy with cash caps, you might be crushing the most vulnerable participants, not the most sophisticated evaders.
The sophisticated evaders hire accountants and lawyers and find new structures. The cleaning lady loses her income or gets pushed into a formal arrangement she can't afford, with tax withholding and social security contributions that eat into already thin margins. The policy doesn't distinguish between a contractor hiding millions and a grandmother selling hand-knit sweaters.
The law, in its majestic equality, forbids rich and poor alike from paying in cash.
Anatole France would approve of that paraphrase. And look, I'm not saying shadow economies are good. They erode the tax base, they undermine labor protections, they create unfair competition for businesses that do follow the rules. But the cure can be worse than the disease if you don't account for why people are in the shadow economy in the first place.
There's a case study I keep thinking about. India's demonetization in 2016. They pulled 86% of currency out of circulation overnight. The stated goal was to crush the shadow economy. What actually happened?
The shadow economy bounced back within 2 years, but millions of small businesses and daily wage workers were devastated in the interim. GDP growth dropped by about 2 percentage points. The informal sector, which employed over 80% of Indian workers, was hit hardest. People who couldn't afford to wait in bank lines for weeks, and those were disproportionately the poor, lost income that never came back. The policy was a masterclass in how not to do this.
The tax evasion problem. Did they at least get the big fish?
The big fish had already moved their wealth into real estate, gold, and offshore accounts long before demonetization. The cash that got turned in at banks, over 99% of it eventually came back into the system. The policy failed on its own terms. It hurt the vulnerable, didn't catch the evaders, and cost the economy billions in lost output.
Which feels like a cautionary tale for anyone who thinks you can solve complex social problems by attacking the medium of exchange.
The medium is never the root cause. Cash is a symptom of the shadow economy, not the cause of it. People evade taxes because taxes are high, enforcement is weak, trust in government is low, or formalization costs are prohibitive. Taking away their cash doesn't fix any of those things. It just changes how they evade.
Where does this leave us? We've got mechanisms that work in the narrow sense. Declared income goes up, VAT revenue goes up. We've got knock-on effect that are troubling. Financial exclusion, privacy erosion, evasion displacement. And we've got an alternative model from Sweden that seems to work better, but might not be universally replicable.
That brings us to the big open question. What happens when cash isn't just restricted, but replaced entirely?
You're talking about central bank digital currencies.
The Bank of Israel is expected to pilot a digital shekel by 2027. The European Union's proposed digital euro includes programmability features, the ability to enforce spending limits, expiration dates, or usage restrictions on digital cash. That's not a cash cap. That's programmable money where the state can determine what you're allowed to spend, when, and on what.
That's a fundamentally different thing. A cash cap says you can't use cash above a certain amount. A CBDC with programmability says the money itself can refuse to be spent in ways the issuer doesn't approve.
Once that infrastructure exists, the cap becomes irrelevant. Why bother limiting cash transactions when you can design money that self-enforces whatever rules the central bank wants? Want to stimulate the economy? Program the digital euro to expire in 30 days if not spent. Want to reduce carbon emissions? Restrict digital shekel usage at non-green businesses. The policy levers become infinite.
The privacy implications become infinite in parallel. If every unit of currency has a history and a set of permissions, financial anonymity ceases to exist, not just for tax evaders, for everyone.
This is why the cash restriction debate matters beyond the immediate policy question. We're watching governments build the infrastructure for total financial surveillance, and they're selling it as tax compliance. The cash caps are the thin end of a very long wedge.
The cash in your pocket isn't just money. It's a tiny privacy device. It doesn't report to anyone. It doesn't expire. It doesn't judge what you spend it on.
we're being asked to trade that privacy device for compliance efficiency without much public debate about what we're actually trading away. The Israel Democracy Institute poll, 68% opposition, suggests that when people are asked directly, they understand the stakes. But the policy is moving faster than the conversation.
That's probably the thing I want listeners to sit with. Not whether cash caps work, they do, in the narrow sense, but whether the cure is proportionate to the disease, and whether we're sleepwalking into a financial surveillance architecture that will have a much harder time rolling back than we did building.
Once the digital shekel exists, once the digital euro exists, once the infrastructure for programmable money is live, the question won't be whether to use it. It'll be whether you're allowed to opt out. And cash restrictions tell us the answer is probably no.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, the British explorer and linguist John Petherick, while traversing what is now South Sudan, recorded accounts of transient lunar phenomena, mysterious flashes and colorations on the moon's surface, and noted that the local Dinka people already had a word for these events, Puchok, which translates roughly to, the moon is bleeding. Petherick's journals, published in 1861, represent one of the earliest ethnographic documentations of lunar transient phenomena observation outside of Western astronomical circles. Modern astronomers still debate the causes of these events. Hypotheses range from meteoroid impacts to outgassing from subsurface lunar cavities, but the Dinka had been observing and naming them for generations before European science took notice.
The moon is bleeding. And also a reminder that a lot of what we think we've discovered, someone else already had a name for. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
Until then, keep some cash in your pocket, while you still can.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.